the first thing we have to understand is, of course, that history, in history, nothing happens in a vacuum. Everything in some form or another has a progenitor, has an idea that spurs yet another idea, which then spurs a movement. And so we can't really talk about Chibat Zion or Chovei Zion. Chovei Zion are those who are members of the Chibat Zion movement, without talking about the turmoil, the almost inconceivable turmoil that took place in the late 18th century, moving on into the 19th century. The Age of Reason, which began, actually even started shortly after Copernicus in the 1600s, and then gave rise to an entire transition of human thinking. Used to be that when people wanted to find truth, they go to their clergymen, they go to the Bible. Let's say in Europe, that's what they did. I don't know what they did in China, but that's what they did in Europe. But with the Age of Reason, spurred on by great minds, many of them religious, by the way. It's not that, you know, Newton was a religious man. Others who helped to contribute great ideas and new ways of thinking were not necessarily, by any means, opposed to religion. Some of them were truly great believers. But the transition that took place led many people to look for truth elsewhere, other than their rabbi, other than their priest, other than the church, or even the Torah. And so therefore, in Europe, particularly it began in Western Europe, there was emancipation. In other words, the Age of Reason gave birth to the idea that all human beings have rights and entitlements, and those bring along with them the right of citizenship, to be an equal partner in the growth of a nation and of a society. Now, in the late 18th century, Joseph, Austria, they determined to loosen up a bit on the Jews, to allow them certain rights. And there were certain people, the beginning of the Haskalah movement, that said, let's grab onto this. But we can't do it if we don't look like everybody else. We can't do it if we don't speak their language. We can't do it if it's apparent to the outside world that their way of life is an anathema to us. And so, among the earliest of the people, Naftali Hertzwiesel, a very religious man, sought to break down those barriers and sought to have Jews begin to, at the very least, not assimilate in the negative sense, but to acculturate, to become a part of the general society. And this, of course, was met with great resistance. To this day, when we speak of the Haskalah, seldom is it seen in a positive light. And that there may be good reason for that, because in the ensuing decades that followed, there was tremendous tension between the Haskalah, the Maskilim, and in particular, the Hasidim. Because as you can imagine, if your whole belief is that Jews need to acculturate, need to become a part of society, and the Hasidic view is the absolute opposite of that, so either they have nothing to do with each other, or there is extraordinary friction and tension, and it was the latter that prevailed. To the point where with the death of one famous Maskil, certain Hasidim danced on his grave. that it's not to say that it's not a slap at Hasidism. It isn't. But that's how deep the tension was. By the way, before we say it was terrible and wrong, which it was, wrong and terrible, he had Hasidim thrown in jail too. All right. So it was unfortunately a two-way street. Well, the Haskalah itself involved several fundamental changes. And by the way, every idea, every movement that stems from the idea leaves a residue. Either it could be positive residue, it could be negative, but it is there. Hegel actually said it about nations, right? Nations are formed, they rise, they make their contributions to the humanity, and then they fall away, and ideally, whatever positive gifts they have given to humanity, that stays. The Romans, the Greeks, those cultures are by and large gone, but the gifts that they gave to the world, the legacy that they had, stays with us. That was Hegel's view. The same thing can be said of ideas and eventually of movements. So the Haskalah itself eventually was relatively short-lived. I would say the heyday of the Haskalah was already over by 1900, just about over. Why? Because it itself gave birth to other movements. And those movements to which it did not give birth, other movements were in other ways spawned by the Haskalah. Example, the Reform movement. Okay? We're going to see how these different movements interacted. The Reform movement had to deal with modernity, because now modernity was open up to the Jews of the Western world. The ghettos that were once in Eastern Europe, but especially that isolation the Jews lived in Western Europe, those barriers were broken down. And with it became a transition from the Jew as a part of a national entity, the Jew as a part of a cohesive group, began to fall away. And so the Jews who were living in Germany and in Western Europe no longer had the comfort of the isolation of either the ghetto or the Judengasse or other forms of Jewish unity. And the Jew who is now free on paper now is alone to fend for herself and to fend for himself in a world, the world of mathematics, the world of universities, the world of music, the world of arts, the world of science. Jews who were looking for entree and thought they would have it, didn't. And the disillusionment was very great. Because they had given up, what had they given up? They gave up their heritage, and now they have neither heritage nor citizenship in its practical form. Yeah, on paper they had it, but in its practical form, they were locked out. So that was the Jew in Western Europe. The Jew in Eastern Europe suffered a different fate. There was movement within Russia and within certain areas. Odessa, the city of Odessa, became a very, very central location for modern thinking Jews. Jews who went to university, had higher educations, higher education, Haskalah Klalit, Gavoah. But they found that they still maintained their Jewish cohesiveness because many ghettos still existed, but they lived in wretched misery, physical misery. They at least had themselves together, but they had no money. And in Western Europe, they had maybe money, but they had there was no kinship to those who were around them, and that's what they wanted very much. The Reform movement said that was spawned by, not directly by the Haskalah, but it is an outgrowth of the Haskalah. The Reform movement said, you don't need your own land. You don't need your own language. If you want to pray, God listens. And it's true, God does listen to any language, but that's b'diavad. That is where we can't, we don't know the language of our people. So God listens to all languages and loves all people, right? But they said you need neither land nor language. If you're in Germany, you're a Jewish German. If you are in France, you are a Frenchman, Jewish Frenchman. And so therefore, the Jew then took his identity from the land in which he or she found himself. But of course, we know from the Dreyfus Affair, we know from so many other different places that that was only on paper. It wasn't in reality. So the Reform Movement took one position. Then there were assimilationists, whom we don't know much about now, but there was an awful lot of intermarriage, even among the grandchildren of Moses Mendelssohn, who himself was an observant man, right? And then, of course, from that came what we call neo-orthodoxy. That was Rav Hirsch. Rav Hirsch said that it's interesting, both Reform and neo-orthodoxy rejected the idea of the Jewish, initiation of return to the land of Israel as a nation. Both rejected it. The Reform rejected it because they believed we are not a nation. Rav Hirsch rejected it for the traditional reason, and that is that we've been sent to our room. Our room is Germany. Our room is France. Our room is Austria. It is Poland. And when God wants us to be out of our room, then he'll bring us out of the room. And then, but the other response to this is, what is nationalism? That's what we're going to talk about tonight. Nationalism. That the watershed year for the Jewish people, for Zionism, for the Jews who are living in America now even, was 1881. In 1881, the Jews who were comfortable in the West, the Jews who lived in Odessa in Russia, who felt very much to be a part of Russian society and Russian intellectual society, they were greeted with the most severe pogroms, 1881, 1882, 83. One pogrom after another, and this led many Jews to say, enough. We can't be here. Tonight we're going to talk about those early decisions about Jews leaving. Some of them decided that they wanted to go to Eretz Israel long before the pogroms of 1881. But certainly the pogroms of 1881 actually convinced even the most ardent maskilim that it didn't work. The presumption was that if I look like a German, I act like a German, I speak like a German, I'll be treated like a German. Certainly in Russia, all of that was turned into complete disillusionment. And therefore, the movement began in earnest of Zionism. Now, Zionism doesn't begin in 1881. It actually, of course, when we talk about Zionism, we were Zionists. Our Bubbies and Zadies were Zionists, and our great-great-great Bubbies and Zadies were Zionists. But when we talk about the Zionism that led directly to the State of Israel, that would be what we would call political Zionism. Political Zionism is different because, again, it was born of the belief that Jews must take their destiny into their own hand, and that we are a nation. They rejected Reform. Reform said that we are neither a nation, nor do we have a language. We have a religion, just like the Catholics have a religion, and no nation, and no particular language, Latin, but as we now know, that's not their language now anymore either. Primarily, that's what the belief was. Now, if you're going to form a nation, there are four what we would call commonplaces, four elements to determine the health of the nation. The first is a nation to be successful has to have a good economy. The second is it needs to have security. The people within the nation need to feel secure. So for example, if you would ask people in Skokie, do you feel secure chances are most people would say on a scale of 1 to 5, at least 3, maybe 4, maybe 5, maybe less now because of the recent outbreaks of anti-Semitism in the country. All right? If you would ask the same question of the child living in the ghetto, living in Englewood, doesn't feel secure. So security is very important for a society. So we taught economy and then security. The third element would be that of culture. For a society to be a healthy society, it has to have culture. It has to have a means of transition from generation A to generation B. The values, the mores, the practices of the first generation to be transmitted to the second generation, and from the second to the third. And then the final one would be what we would call governance. You need a government. You need people to make decisions about the other three elements. Okay? The problem is, if you want to start a state, where do you begin? Do you start with governance? Do you start with forming a state? Do you want to have a healthy society? Or do you start with making the people secure? And let's say somebody like Jabotinsky, who came much later, said, you got to be secure. You'll never be a state unless you revise the way you look at yourselves. You're not victims. As long as you see yourself as a victim, you're going to be a victim. Right? Then you had others who said, you need it, Borokhov and others, who said, Moses Hess, some of you may have read of Moses Hess, the early Zionists said, you start with an economy. You start with how people can acquire material wealth. And how are the limited resources of a society distributed among the inhabitants? So, as you know, there are various different ways. There's socialism, there's communism, there's capitalism, an amalgam of more than one of them, adjustments. So those are all four elements. Now the question is, where do you start? Governance? Tonight we're going to discuss, do you start with governance, establishing a state, or do you start with culture? Because if the people who come to this state that is not yet in existence, if they have no received culture, if they have no received legacy and heritage, then the state is not going to be a Jewish state, but a state of the Jews. And as Ahad Am said, we don't need another Switzerland. We're looking for a Jewish state, not a state of the Jews. So tonight, we're going to explore now very, very passionate views about where do we start. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the concept of Chibat Tzion, which probably the most famous of all of the Chibat Tzion leaders was Ahad Am. Certainly the most articulate was Ahad Am. And of course, his major battle was with Theodor Herzl, who said, you start with a state. Herzl dedicated the last 8 years of his life, from the time of the Dreyfus trial until the day that he simply died of a heart attack, knowing full well that in the last year or two of his life, that as long as he continued the pace that he did, his weakened heart would give out. But he, and I want to stress, even though this is about Chibat Tzion, and they were certainly, Ahad Ha'am and Herzl were definitely bitter intellectual enemies. Nothing appalls me more than to hear people say, oh, Herzl, he wanted Uganda. What nonsense. Anybody that could make a statement that Herzl wanted Uganda means he either doesn't know anything about Uganda or doesn't know anything about Herzl. And unfortunately, that canard is repeated over and over again, as if he was willing to give away Eretz Israel. When he himself wrote, when Herzl, you know, what happened was England said after the Kishinev pogrom in 1903, so England said, look, we have a piece of land for you. It's in Uganda, but you'll be safe there. And Herzl, who was absolutely grief-stricken over the Kishinev pogrom, which was, shall we say, the final statement or the final nail in the coffin of emancipation. So many Jews were killed so deliberately with such connivance of the government. He said, "We got to do something now." And he said, "It is a first step, not the last." And he said, "Nothing will ever replace Zion." And for that, unfortunately, there are people, you'll hear them say, all they know of Herzl is he wanted Uganda. What a shanda. What a shanda. Now, however, Achad Am had serious, serious disagreements. So we're going to read now several pieces about the approach to Eretz Yisrael. I'd like to share several ideas with you. First of all, the idea, many of you are aware, maybe all of you are aware, that this idea of returning to Eretz Israel and abandoning the idea that Jews must wait for the Geula, but rather Jews are not only allowed to, but they are commanded to initiate a return to Eretz Israel, was begun actually by Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischa, who was, his intellect and his credentials are so great that if you look at any standard Mishnayot, I'm not talking about the Kahati Mishnayot, which certainly in and of themselves are a masterpiece, but the Jochen Boas and editions in the back, of all the millions of rabbis that ever commented on the Mishnah, his commentary is there. So here's what he writes in 1865 or 1870. The redemption of Israel, for which we long, is not to be imagined as a sudden miracle. The Almighty, blessed be His name, will not suddenly descend from on high and command His people to go forth. Neither will He send the Messiah from heaven in a twinkling of an eye to sound the great shofar for the scattered of Israel and gather them to Jerusalem. Boy, oh boy, if you're reading that for the first time, you say to yourself, this is written by some reform person, right? Because it could have been that, those lines. He will not surround the holy city with a wall of fire or cause the holy temple to descend from heaven. The bliss and the miracles that he were promised by his servants, the prophets, will certainly come to pass. Everything will be fulfilled. But we will not run in terror and flight, for the redemption of Israel will come by slow degrees. Can you imagine? What a prophetic statement. And the ray of deliverance will shine forth gradually. Okay? So this is the idea, this is the brainchild of Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer, and here's his proposal. And this, of course, this is the inspiration. Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer's proposal is the inspiration for the Chibat Zion movement. He doesn't mention governments, doesn't mention how leaders are chosen, he doesn't talk about. Why do the people of Italy and other countries sacrifice their lives for the land of their fathers, while we, like men bereft of strength and courage, do nothing? Are we inferior to all the other peoples, who have no regard for life and fortune as compared with the love of their land and nation? Let us take to heart the examples of the Italians, the Poles, the Hungarians, who laid down their lives and possessions in the struggle for national independence, while we, the children of Israel, who have the most glorious and holiest of lands as our inheritance, are spiritless and silent. We should be ashamed of ourselves. This is what he writes. And the book that he wrote was called Drishat Zion. Drishat Zion. It's a relatively thick book, and a person of the stature of Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer could write such a work. I got to tell you, by the way, a person to the right of me once said, I'll never get over that. I said to him, what about, he said that no Gedolim or Zionists. I said, what about Ritzvi Hirsch Kalischer? He said, I heard he was Chayzer on that. I heard he retracted it. So, by the way, checkmate. Once you heard he retracted. But of course, You know, but that's the out. Again, that's not to slam people to the right. There's reasons why people were opposed and still are opposed to certain elements of Zionism, but we can't deny truth. Truth is that one of the great Gedolim of all time wrote this, and he meant it, and he followed up. By the way, his grandson was among the first. Rabbi Yehuda was among the very first of the Chovevei Tzion movement. He was at the Katowice Conference, as a matter of fact. The Katowice Conference was called in 1884, 3 years after the 1881 pogroms, originally they wanted it in Romania. They wanted to hold it in Romania. But the movement itself was too young then. At that point, it did not coalesce sufficiently. Perhaps part of it is because of the fact that Chad Ha'am had not come onto the scene yet, nor had, from the standpoint of truly great Gedolim, people like the Netziv of Naftali Tzvi Hirsch, Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, and Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines. These were very, very great people, as we shall see. And they gave impetus to the movement itself. Now, one of the statements by also Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, who also around that same time had the same wonderful thought, the Jews need, and God wants Jews, to take the Geula partially in their own hand. God will determine whether it will bear fruit, but we have to do something. So, Rav Alkalai says the following: Hashem desires that we be redeemed in dignity. We cannot therefore migrate en masse. Why, he says, for we should have to live in tent-like dwellers all over the fields of the Holy Land. First of all, that's sort of prophetic in and of itself, but in a beautiful way, that in the 50s, within 10 years, the decade after the founding of the state, they had tent cities everywhere. And it was not an easy existence. And it wasn't people would think as a dignified existence. But remember, dignity is a state of mind. That's the reality. Dignity is a state of mind. If you feel that you're being made inferior, then you are. If you feel that you have a cause, no matter how poor the Chofetz Chaim was, guaranteed he had dignity. Guaranteed. Right? Why? Because he had a cause to live for his whole life, so he had dignity. But not everybody can live that way, right? Not everybody can see that. So that's why Rav Alkalai said that we won't come all at one time. We're not going to come all at one time. Now, I believe it was in 1874, or around that period of time. It was after that. It was 1884. Again, after the watershed year of the pogroms of Europe. Leon Pinsker wrote a very important work called, anybody know? Auto-Emancipation, correct. He didn't even have to write his essay, because the title tells you everything. He said, and this again was as much an indictment of the Haskalah as it was a call for going to Eretz Israel and Zionism. The Haskalah was a failure, he said. Not even for religious reasons it was a failure. Pinsker said it was a failure because what did it do? It got the Jews out of the ghetto and had no replacement for it. It took the Jews from being at least a part of a group where if one suffered, everybody suffered. When one rejoiced, everybody rejoiced. Now, each Jew is emancipated on his own. Right. But his emancipation means nothing. Because in reality, the only way you can really be emancipated is if the people around you see you as an equal. But the people around us don't see us as an equal. And he said, Pinsker, by the way, was a doctor. He was an MD. So he said he actually defined anti-Semitism as a disease. All right? He thought like a doctor. He said, this is a genetic disease, he saw, almost like a genetic disease that will not be cured as long as we're in Europe. It can only be cured by separation. And who's going to do the separation? Auto-emancipation. We must emancipate ourselves. Don't wait for the Duke, the Archbishop, the Pope. Don't wait for them to emancipate us. They may say it, it's not going to happen. So he wrote Auto-Emancipation, and here's just a couple of his ideas. The Jews are not a living nation, they are everywhere aliens. Therefore, they're despised because we're an alien. The civil and political emancipation of the Jews is not sufficient to raise them in the estimation of peoples. I'm sorry to say that that's the same thing we've had in the United States of America. In 1863, we had the Emancipation Proclamation, and African-American people, now again, I know there are many of them who are richer than all the people in our room, but the point is, in the eyes of many, many people, they're not my equal. And so therefore, they're not truly, completely emancipated. Being emancipated on a paper is not the same as being seen as an equal by your neighbors, by the governmental structures and by the societal structures that we have. And so Pinsker said in the end that ultimately he was really among the very first people to say we all must leave Europe, do something, leave Europe. And he even said it doesn't have to be to Israel. He said it can be to America, but we need to get out of here. Because I guess for some reason he believed that in America that in fact the Jews would be treated as equals. He was somewhat right. So back in the 1880s and 1890s. So that's Leo Pinsker. Now we come to Achad HaAm. I'll read you a couple of pieces from Achad HaAm. I'm going to conclude in 5 minutes. Achad HaAm was perhaps the most original thinker of all the early Zionists. As I said, he was at loggerheads with Herzl. Herzl said, we need a state. And Achad HaAm said, a state with Jews in it is no state that I want. We need a state that will both receive the culture and the spirit of those who preceded us and will be able to pass it on to those who follow us. That can only happen with education, with a cultural background. The state. Now, listen to what he writes. There's a couple of selections that I could choose, but I want, in the interest of brevity, I want to. Yes, I'm just going to. I'm going to read this for you, because this sums up his view as again the acknowledged intellectual leader of Chibat Zion. Chibat Zion. No less than Zionism. Now, here's what he does. He makes a distinction. Zionism is a political entity, as far as he's concerned. And that's the way Herzl was concerned. When I talk about Zionism, Herzl says, I'm talking about a state. He wrote two books on that, and essays as well. And he spent his last years going from dignitary to dignitary, to king, to prince, to wherever he could go to see if he could get a land and a state. But he writes, Achad HaAm writes, and the Herzl calls these Zionists. That means the establishment of a Jewish state. Chibat Zion, no less than Zionism, wants a Jewish state and believes in the possibility of the establishment of a Jewish state in the future. Okay. He wrote this in 1898, I believe. He attended one and only one of the World Zionist Congresses. One was all he could take. Yeah? But while Zionism looks to the Jewish state to furnish a remedy for poverty and to provide complete tranquility and national glory, Chibat Zion knows that our state will not give all these things until universal righteousness, listen to their writing, universal righteousness is enthroned and holds sway over the nations and states. It looks to a Jewish state to provide only a secure refuge for Judaism. His goals are deceptively simple. And a cultural bond to unite our nation. Zionism therefore begins its work with political propaganda. Chibat Zion begins with the national culture. Because only through the national culture and for its sake can a Jewish state be established in such a way as to correspond with the will and the needs of the Jewish people? So, as far as Achad HaAm was concerned, we can wait. We need to get the Jews into the land of Israel. Then we need to give them schools and educational centers and cultural centers. He was all for learning the Talmud, learning Tanakh, learning all of the things that make us intellectually Jewish. And then, because after all, you can only, my mechanic can only make a decision on my car because he knows cars. And so therefore, if I want to be able to make a decision about Jews, I have to know Judaism. Then I can make a decision about Judaism. Maybe not cars, but Judaism I can, right? And so therefore, that is his view in a nutshell about what we must have. Now, almost done, the Netziv. A lot of controversy. The Netziv of Naftali Tzvi Yehuda of Berlin, who was, for 30 years, he was the Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, which was the greatest yeshiva, the mother of all yeshivas, is what it was called. And it was known as the intellectual powerhouse of yeshivas. He was very excited about Chibat Zion, because he believed the Chibat Zion is the proper approach. Now, there were two arguments that were raised against Chibat Zion. One is that the people in the movement itself, the majority of them were not observant. The second thing is the majority of Jews in the Chibat Zion movement in Eretz Israel were not. And so therefore, many of the Gedolim, even though they themselves may have said this is good, could not openly express it, and did not. The Netziv was known to be a follower of Chibat Zion. And in addition to that, Rav Yitzchak Yaakov Reines, he was the one who was the standard bearer for Chibat Zion. He formulated much of its religious ideology. He worked very, very hard to do his best to make sure that those people who were involved with Chibat Zion, who were not necessarily in and of themselves observant, that they at least do nothing to disturb the religious and spiritual tranquility of Eretz Israel. He wasn't able to do that. Neither was the Netziv. So the Netziv actually pulled out. So that's why when I talked about Chibat Zion, it is a magnificent idea. And like all movements, the remnants are here. The beautiful remnants are here in Eretz Israel. Some of the faults are here too. Yeah, absolutely. But the remnants are here. The tremendous amount of learning that goes on in Eretz Israel. Again, whether it's Haredi learning or it's non-Haredi learning, it's learning. It is a vital part, lifeblood of the state. They have to iron out politically how that's going to work. But the fact that a Jewish state has Torah just literally in the streets itself is magnificent. Now I'm going to close with a statement of Rav Kook. Now Rav Kook was not a part of the Chibat Zion. Actually, he had his own disagreements with the idea of Tzionut and Tzioniut. He formulated once a party called Yerushalmiut. Did anybody ever hear that? Yerushalmiut. Yeah. He said, "What?" Listen to the brilliance of Rav Kook. He said, "What Tzionut wants to do for the Jewish body, that's what Yerushalmiut must do for the Jewish soul." And so it didn't get much off the ground, but at least not as a party. But it certainly, we are his followers. I'll conclude with six lines. Rav Kook writes, "Tzrichim la'orir et tchiyat Yisrael b'chol hakochot hamechunasim ba'uma." We must arouse the renaissance of the Jewish people with all of the ability that is embedded within us as a nation. Bechol Torata, through its Torah. Bechol Emunata, through its faith. Bechol Midotea, through its personality and through its character. Bechol Tova, with all of its goodness, or Tuva. Bechol Oshra, with all of its material wealth, b'chol kocha, with all of its strength, b'chol hegyonotea, through all of its thinking and thinkers, b'chol shirata, through its poetry and poets, b'chol otzma, almost intransigence and not doing things wrong, b'chol chum chaya, with all of the heat of its life, or the ardor of its life, b'chol sichla v'askalata, through its intellect and thinking, b'chol mirza, through its energy, v'nitzchon kishronoteha, and through the ability of its talents, et kol odot kulam, all of it must come together. That is what Rav Kook said. That is the essence of Chibat Zion. That would be the essence, although not directly of Achad HaAm, because his idea of the Jewish spirit was, there was a lot of overlap, but it wasn't exactly the same. But in the end, what we have as Zionists, RZA, all of us have this idea of Rav Kook, of all of the talent of the Jewish people. That even comes before the political aspect. And may it be Hashem's will that we will see both. We will see both a firm governmental structure that will lead our people in making Jewish decisions, because they know how to make Jewish decisions because of the culture and because of all of the learning that takes place. Okay. Oh, yeah.